Welcome back to Sci-Fi and Fantasy Read-Along. How are my friends doing?
Well, Yule's doing just great. How's Phil?
Oh, Phil is doing amazing. He's loving every minute of his life. The in-laws are here.
I heard you got a nap today.
Oh, yeah, my God, yes. I haven't got a nap all week, and I took a nap for like an hour and a half, and I feel like $1 million.
That's good. I'm glad to hear it.
Aren't naps wonderful?
I don't know. I don't like to take them, but I enjoy them once I've had them.
Well, instead of crying, I'd rather have a nap.
Yeah, I guess me too. Let's get caught up, yeah?
Yeah, let's do it.
Where did we leave off last episode? It was chapter 4. How did it end? Do you remember?
It ended, and I really like this. I don't think we talked about it enough, but I thought it was one of those important messages. It ended with, yes, the talk about free will. Is it only on Earth? Is there any talk of free will? I guess either we have the illusion that we have free will, or we have the delusion that there's free will.
All right, so we left off talking about free will, and we pick up chapter 5, which is what we're going to be talking about today. Just after Billy Pilgrim has been kidnapped by the Tralfamadorian flying saucer, and he's on his way to the Time Warp. All right, so have you guys ever read Valley of the Dolls?
No.
No, I saw the movie Beyond the Valley of the Dolls, though.
It's like one of the, I think it's still in the Guinness Book of World Records as being like the most sold book fiction.
Really?
31 million copies or something like that. Ridiculously popular. And it was in its ridiculous, I mean, it had got published in 65. So in right now in this book, it's 1967. So the book's been out for 2 years or so. And it's so popular that the Tralfamadorians are taking it back to a museum.
I think that's crazy.
What does crazy mean, first of all?
Well, it's in context.
Crazy means you're getting married to someone you don't want to marry.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
No, that was tactical, and I highly approve.
No, it wasn't. He said it was a symptom of his illness. It was a symptom of his disease that he was marrying her.
Well, we'll get into that.
We will get into that.
All right.
What does crazy mean? I'm trying to encourage you not to use words like crazy because it doesn't really tell us anything.
It's funny because like I'm literally like on the tip of my tongue trying to explain what crazy is, but you can't.
I know, and I'm disrupting you because I don't want to have to get an explanation. I just want you to straight up tell me.
Okay, well, I'm getting to the...
And it's...
I'm getting to the because part. So I think it's crazy because it was brought into this book probably late in the writing stage, right before he published it, right?
What?
I just said right. I hate when people say that.
What are you getting at? Because I don't know if there's any foundation for your assertion.
Yeah, come on, Yule. Get on with it.
It's random, like a lot of the book really is. I didn't see any sort of connection between the story itself and this insertion.
What insertion?
He inserted Valley of the Dolls into the novel.
I'm so confused.
I don't think that you've got any grounds to stand on for that.
He is quoting a real novel that was written by a real person, but at the same chapter, he's highly influenced by a fake author who comes from his hometown who writes fake novels. Not fake, as in they only exist in this book.
Yule, have you ever watched the show Hogan's Heroes?
Of course.
Okay, I have not.
Oh yeah, there's a lot of that in this.
Okay, I was wondering the same thing because Hogan's Heroes also came out in 1965. Like super, super famous, poorly written novel that he's referring to. And then like all of the stuff, it just rang so many alarm bells that I had to look it up and see, you know, if Hogan's Heroes was, you know, super popular in that period of time. And it was, you know, it's in its third season when this book came out or whatever.
Oh, right. There you go. It's funny you should mention that because there's a component of this chapter, which is, well, it's just like Hogan's Heroes.
So instead of assuming, to me, like, I don't make the same assumption that you made, Philip, that he just threw it in there. Like, I'm assuming that what happened was these things were so popular in their time that he included them in his book.
That might be a fair assumption. So I watched the trailer for Valley of the Dolls. It seemed to me it was a group of women who are making their way through life, and all of them seemed to have problems with drugs or alcohol or both. And how they, and their lives in general. It seemed to me it was a lot of drama. But I wonder if it inspired him because he felt on some level maybe a corollary between the troubles that they're having in his own life. That's the only thing I could think of, but I didn't, you know, it didn't even occur to me, I don't know why, that it was just immensely popular. And I looked up the ages, too. It was very popular in its time. They made a movie out of it.
It's still selling copies, man.
I believe you. Let's not do that one for our next podcast.
Well, Billy Pilgrim read The Valley of the Dolls. He thought it was okay and that the characters had some ups and downs, but he didn't want to keep reading it. So he asked the Tralfamadorians for some of their novels, since that was the only one they had in English that he could read on the trip.
Right. And they're like, you're never going to be able to understand it. He's all, well, I'd like to try.
They had it all on microfilm.
Yeah, those were the English books.
Oh, yeah, okay, yeah, yeah. They had a microfilm. I put LOL there because I laughed. I'm like, yeah, these like fantastically evolved and advanced race has all these books on microfilm. I just thought it was kind of funny.
Well, they also have an interest in zoos and Jacqueline Suzanne's novel. And, I mean, obviously, they have strange tastes, don't you think?
You know, I didn't think about that, but, I mean, to us it's strange, but I anticipated they would be strange.
They are alien, after all.
Well, I mean, maybe the thing of the matter is that they're only getting stuff that's, like, of the time.
So do you guys think there's any importance in the description of how a Tralfamadorian novel is set up?
Well, they talk about it, like, being, like, telegraphs, right?
Condensed, important information revealed in a burst.
No, yeah, it's like texting, right? A telegram is a short message. Usually, often, like, very condensed, because you pay by the word.
All right, so do you guys think there's any significance to the way that their novels are laid out?
Well, yeah, go ahead, Yule.
Wait, yeah,
you're the
me?
One saying yes.
Well, I was.
Not you. Philip is the one that just said yes.
I know, that was really strange.
He volunteered you to do the heavy lifting.
Oh, okay, well, yeah, fine. I mean, I'll go with it. I think there is. The thing about this novel, and the way I'm reading it is, he writes something to its conclusion and then goes back and further examines it later on. And that's, it's a lot of it is just, I can't, all right, give you an example.
Yeah, give me an example, because I don't understand what you mean.
He'll say like, oh, this dude got shot for stealing stuff. And then later on we meet that guy and he'll remind us that he got shot by stealing stuff. And we'll see lots of things about that person, and we don't, you know, we haven't got to that part yet. And then it's like, I feel like he writes like a typewriter works, you know, you write and then you have to slam the whatever the cartridge to the other side.
It's called the carriage return.
The carriage return. You have to slam it. Every time he slams it, it's the beginning of a next part of the same story. You know, it's just...
Okay, I get you.
Filling it back in. A case in point, we know about his wife way more now than we ever did before. But we knew that she dies. You know, we get to the end of her life. He lets us know.
That's like the
now
first thing
we're
we
getting
learned.
In parts of her when he's in the hospital. And them on their honeymoon. We know she dies.
Mm-hmm.
The way they described these books is that they, like, imagine, like, every single page is, like, a different snippet and description. And the, and the Tralfamadorians see it, can essentially read the entire book simultaneously and get the full experience of the book, I don't know about instantly, but they're all time-related. And they produce an image of life that is beautiful and surprising and deep. But it's all random. And if you think about it, this book is the exact same way.
So is the way he's writing it the way the Tralfamadorians write books? Or at least his version of it.
Yeah, exactly.
The closest analogy as we can get. Do you guys remember how they described their view of the universe as being luminous spaghetti?
At the very beginning,
yeah. They can see where the stars are going to be as well as where they were. So it's like a long exposure film.
Yeah, they can see the star streams. And then when they say they look at a human, they see like... Essentially, they look like a vast millipede. And they see us as babies, right? The tail is the baby.
Yeah, they have baby legs all the way up to old people legs.
That's an interesting description, but again, you're trying to apply three-dimensional descriptions to four-dimensional comprehension.
Right, and I do think that that's part of what this chapter is trying to do in the way that he's writing it. I think he's trying to get as close as he can. So I agree with you, Yule. I think you're right.
All right, excellent. Way to go, Phil.
Teamwork!
After the reading material is discussed, this flying saucer arrives at the time warp, and Billy Pilgrim is flung back into childhood. He's 12 years old. He's standing on the edge of the Grand Canyon with his parents.
He's scared that he's going to fall in.
His mom touches him and he pees his pants.
There's like that French guy or somebody that's like, hey, do people commit suicide here? And the guy's like, oh, yeah.
Three a year. Is there not a railing? I mean, is that what I mean?
I'm sorry, you can't rail off the entire Grand Canyon.
I know that, but you know, there are the major places where people can park or see far down or whatever. The great vistas are definitely.
Well, now it's
railed.
Worse. Now they have like the bridge or whatever, or the sky bridge, where you go out over and it's a glass floor and you can.
Oh God, no!
I know, it's what I said. And then
no. There's no amount of money that you could. You want to torture me? You drug me, put me out in the middle, and leave me there to wake up. That'd be the worst.
They had either it was at the Grand Canyon. It was a place, other place with a similar glass floor, and one of the panes broke.
They do that in like some other countries. They have like the video floor, and it cracks underneath them.
Ooh.
Oh, I've seen the YouTube videos.
That's a good trick.
And everybody like jumps back far.
Oh, for sure.
Like, what would you do if that happened? You wouldn't be able to do anything.
Well, I remember I went to the Eiffel Tower when I was 11 years old. Unfortunately, at that time, there were like huge rusted holes in the floor of the Eiffel Tower where everybody was like milling around, walking around. I'm like, oh my God. I mean, a kid could fall through those holes.
When your mom touched you, did you pee your pants?
You know, I didn't.
Bummer.
This must have been like a horrific family gathering. I mean, they had 7 blowouts on the way to get there.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he's not enjoying it at all.
Billy Pilgrim, as a child, is terrified that he's going to fall in. And then they have that discussion about the number of suicides that happen per year there at the Grand Canyon. And then they jump to just a few days later, they're at Carlsbad Caverns.
Yay!
And we have, again, another park ranger kind of giving them the guided tour. And again, he feels like terrified of the, you know, the oppressive ceiling that he thinks is going to fall in on him. So he, in general, I think he's just a terrified little kid.
Do you think he's really that scared of everything?
He pissed his pants, man. I'd say yes.
Do you think it's a true story?
I don't, actually.
That someone pissed their pants when their mom touched them at the Grand Canyon?
Somebody's probably done that, but
I mean, I haven't been to the Grand Canyon, but I'd probably pissed myself then.
All right, so radium dials, yeah?
Yeah, well, they turn off the lights, and they're like, this is probably the first time you're going to be in, like, total darkness.
Pure darkness. And that's probably
and
true.
And I was thinking of, during that time when I was reading this, of deprivation tanks.
Yeah.
And I heard that, like, if you're in for an hour, let's say, they say the first, like, 10 minutes is, like, the longest amount of time that you've ever spent. And then, like, the last part of it is, like, it goes by super quick.
Okay.
Your mind races until you calm down?
I guess that's what it is. Yeah. You're not used to being in...
deprived of sense.
Yeah, and I kind of feel like... that's kind of how I feel like this chapter kind of, or this part of the chapter is.
So, 18, you mentioned the word radium dials, and a lot of words and phrases he uses become connected to other things within the chapter, and they repeat, and so, like, so it goes is an example. Right. And he mentioned radium dials here, and he described the faces of Russians in the same manner. I don't get the visualization there, but he does.
Well, I don't get it either. I mean, I don't feel confident that I get it. Do you have any inclination of what it means in this moment, though?
I couldn't, other than it's like they turn the lights out, and
his dad brings out his watch.
And the only thing he can see is the radium dial on his father's watch. And the only thing I can think of is that, yes, he's now at a German prisoner of war camp, and he is loathed and reviled because Weary has basically sold him out. And everybody's out to get him. And maybe the only friendly people he has, the only light in the darkness, is the Russians.
Yeah. Well, there is that Russian that is awfully nice to him later.
I don't know what that is. I laughed out loud.
Well, I don't know if it's really nice. But, you know, I mean, the smallest amount of kindness that's being shown to him is like that guy that's untangling him in the fence.
All right.
Oh, sorry.
Don't jump. Don't jump.
Yeah. Oh, don't jump in time like this book at all.
The radium watch, is that the thing that triggers him to travel back to the war?
Yes.
Well, I don't know about triggering, but it was at that point he did jump again.
As I'm reading this book, you know, I like the fact that we're spending time to go through it slowly, chapter by chapter, rather than reading it, you know, all in, you know, a couple days or something like that. And because of the way it's written, and because of the way we're reading it, it's hard to remember exactly when I actually read something like about this thing for the first time in this book. Was it in this chapter? Was it
that means a few that he's chapters doing ago? His job.
Yeah, right. I agree.
The way that you just described the Tralfamadorian novels, the mimicry that Vonnegut is doing to match that kind of style, that means it's doing his job.
Wow.
You're seeing it through a spectrum, through time. So let's go back to the delousing station, 1944, yeah?
Yes, sir.
He said he went from total darkness to total light, and then that's when he finds himself back in the delousing station. I think the long and short of this section is they're getting registered in that book, they're waiting in line, they're getting new dog tags, and etc. Right, and this is where they see the Russians. They're starving to death, and he describes their faces as being like radium dials. That means glowing to me.
Yeah,
I don't know why they'd have glowing faces if they're starving to death, but
Is there a luminescence that comes with not eating?
I did think, and this is just comedy here, when he was describing that everybody got like a normal jacket and he got this tiny little fur line thing that was like way too small for him.
Split up the back, lost its sleeves.
And the Germans were laughing. Yeah. But he is. I swear I laughed. He said,
yeah, I did too.
It had a fur collar and a lining of crimson silk and had apparently been made for an impresario about as big as an organ grinder's monkey.
And it was full of bullet holes.
Yeah. Well, he said that too, but yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
I just imagined this little capuchin and that's what he looks like.
That one moment of violence when they're waiting in line here and the guy gets his teeth knocked out by the German soldier, did that mean anything to y'all?
Well, I mean, the end result of it did, but do you know what do you, the American said, I didn't mean it, they didn't mean anything by it, and then he says, like, I didn't know he would be able to speak English. I was just kind of wondering what he said.
Yeah, I was wondering as well, but obviously yeah. It was something insulting. The German soldier took it to be an insult and smashed his teeth in.
Right.
The American soldier was like, why me? And that made me think about the... Yeah.
Like when...
I guess it was last chapter. Pilgrim's, yeah.
Yeah, when Pilgrim goes up with the Tralfamadorians.
And he asked the same question. And the answer is not exactly the same, but it's really, really similar. He says, why me? And you're like, why you? Why anyone?
I took note of that also. It's almost the exact same... It's a second vision... Well, I don't know. Whatever. It's a repeat of that previous encounter, except...
You mean like an iteration?
An iteration. There we go. That is a fancy word. But not really that fancy, but that perfectly describes it.
Does it mean anything to you? What did it do for you? Because all it did to me was make me think about the previous chapter. That's all it did.
Well, not just that. There's also this element of German guards just kind of going about doing what they're supposed to do. You know... Or maybe the way that war is described in this chapter and also in previous chapters, we are all just like really pawns doing what, you know, the other people want us to do. We're neither good nor bad, you know?
No villains.
Or villains or heroes.
Right.
To some, obviously. Later on, we're going to get into that about appreciating people being in the war.
Right.
But... I think as far as right now and taking a look at it, it's like, yeah, of course. I have no control over the situation. I have to be here. Someone has to be here.
Does someone have
I'm
to...
I'm just filling a role, you know?
Does someone have to knock your teeth in because you said something? I don't get it. I don't see that thing as... I don't see your point, I guess, is what I'm getting at.
Well, I get Yule's point. I think this is just... an example of an iteration, as you said, of reinforcing that we're all on a kind of a fixed timeline, and it, like you said, there is no good or bad. There's just what happens. And he was using this as an example to reinforce the Tralfamadorian point of view, which is They don't ask those kind of questions about why things happen because they know exactly why.
So It Goes?
Well, I think So It Goes is a different thing, but I mean, we could find deeper meaning here, and then maybe there is. And I think the whole point of that whole setup was just to say those lines again. Why me? And why anybody?
Why me?
Is that we're on, you know?
Why you?
Why anybody? No, essentially we're on, from the Trail Famidorian's point of view, we don't have free will, and we're all on the railroad. Yet another metaphor, the railroad.
All right, so they've been registered in the Little Red Book. They've been given new dog tags, I believe.
Yeah.
And they're led through many, many gates. This is when they see the Russian with a radium glowing face. And they're led to a nondescript shed, just like any of another thousand sheds just like it. And a guard knocks on the door, and then it bursts open. Can you describe for me, please, what comes out?
Yeah, Phil, what comes out?
I like how you guys volunteer each other for the important parts.
Wait.
This is the part.
I'm looking for the part that he's mentioning.
50 British officers singing.
Yeah, but even...
A musical.
Yeah, but wait...
They're singing from Pirates of Penzance. They're singing...
Oh, that's right. Yeah, right there. That's
hail,
right.
Hail, the gang's all here. I love this in the next part where we're finding out how the Englishmen have been faring during the war. Holy cow. This is where the Hogan's Hero bit comes in.
That's right.
They've got... What was it they said? They were supposed to get 50 whatever...
Parcels of food.
And there was a clerical error, and they got 500, and they're like, oh, we know this is wrong, and they started squirreling it away.
500 a month.
Yeah.
For however long the Red Cross was delivering food to prisoners of war, which is a weird concept to me, but I guess that's how it works. I don't really know.
Well,
war on some level is civilized.
Oh, yeah.
European wars are civilized, apparently.
They get their little ration of cigarettes and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I love it.
Oh, they described how many tons of materials they had. Tons that they had squirreled away. And, you know, they're like wheeling and dealing with the Germans for this because the Germans don't have much.
Well, they traded tobacco and something else for... Oh, it's chocolate and tobacco, I believe, for all of the wood, nails, and hammers and stuff that they needed to set up the stage and to, like, make the place nice because they found out 12 days ago that they were going to have American visitors and they really wanted to make a special arrival for them.
The correlation with Hogan's Heroes is there. I mean, these British officers are, like, living like kings in prison. Mm-hmm. And meanwhile, the Russians are starving to death.
I know. I thought that was... there's something to that. I'm not sure what it is, other than they didn't share.
Well, the one thing they didn't say is that, or we haven't covered, is that these British soldiers have basically escaped or almost escaped from every prison they've ever put them in. And so they put them here in the very center of a vast prisoner of war camp and kind of keep them isolated in the very center. So they can't tunnel out. They can't, you know, cross through all these camps. And so they're just making the best of it. And they really are making the best of it.
They're very fit. They've been working out. They sing every night together. They're very well practiced. And they're all middle-aged. They're all officers. And they have been they were among the earliest prisoners of war in the war. So they've been there for 4 years or so at this point.
It's pretty amazing that they're in this condition, but yes.
They have all that food, you know. And the Germans love them. The Germans think that they're stylish and they're elegant, and this is how war should be. You know, it should be kind of fun, and
that's what they said. Is like, oh, and these British officers were like everything a British officer and gentleman should be.
The English officers, when they're done singing their song and they actually get to look at these Americans, they think they're kind of ragtag and etc. They're disappointed in what they see.
I imagine they're like, all right, we're going to like do this big old performance and we're going to be really awesome for these guys that are coming in. And then as they're singing, they're probably so disillusioned by what they're seeing. You know, the Americans are just like these wimpy, you know, it sounds like they're reprobates.
Well, one of the officers said that he had expected them to be older, that he just assumed, because they hadn't been in the war for so long, they'd been prisoners for so long, he just assumed that everybody was like them in their 40s,
And they're all kids.
This, like, the children's crusade. So we get the subtitle coming from an English officer at this point.
Well, you know, and I think that's, you think that, I don't know if the British officers are just being a little haughty here, but I mean, they see the Russians in the same camp as starving to death. And then they probably see how prisoners come in. And the Americans are no different. They may have been, you know, like hearty and hale and wholesome like 2 weeks ago, but they've just gone on this long train ride full of like filth and deprivation and no food and no water. And, you know, they're exhausted and starving and weak and scared. I don't think it was fair that he gave him a shakedown like that. And remember, these are officers, but the people being brought in are overwhelmingly...
enlisted.
Enlisted, yeah. Big difference. It's a culture gap there.
So British hospitality, such that it is, the British officers had prepared this massive feast with their surplus food stocks, and Billy doesn't remember eating it. He just wakes up after passing out, and he's in the middle of laughing and watching the play Cinderella that's being performed by the British officers.
What the hell is wrong with him?
I don't know what's wrong with him, but I will repeat something I said before. I don't really like him.
So much is happening to him. It's Maybe true. I can forgive him a little bit.
Yeah, you can forgive him a little bit, but, I mean, he's a coward.
Well, he's aloof. I mean, when he's being run through, doesn't he get caught on fire?
Caught on fire.
Yeah, well, he's like wearing that really lame coat, and he's standing too close to the furnace, and then he doesn't even know that he's on fire, and they're like banging him out, you know, banging it out of him.
You're on fire, lad.
He doesn't even know what a Jerry is.
That's true, yeah.
I don't know, again, it's like he's not of that time, even though he is.
He's a ding-dong, man.
Yeah, he's a ding-dong.
He's an absolute ding-dong. I don't know, he's certainly not somebody to look up to. During the play, he starts shrieking. He's like, he goes from laughing at what's going on the stage to shrieking, and then he won't stop. And I have to say, I've had an experience like this with Philip.
I knew you were going to say that.
Philip started laughing while we were playing D&D one day, and he wouldn't stop laughing, and it ended in us like kind of torturing him for a while because he wouldn't shut up.
Say what?
The officers did the exact same thing that we would have done if we had it. They took Billy into the hospital. And they injected him with morphine, and they tied him to the bed.
Well, at least he got morphine, which I had my first taste of it.
I think he enjoyed it, but I'm not sure.
Oh my gosh, this book is so random, it drives me zany. Maybe because I just don't... my brain doesn't flip like that, you know, very easily. And I'm having a hard time, like, just following any sort of coherency here. And now he's having a dream about, like, giraffes. And he goes into detail about their horns. And, like, oh, they had horns like doorknobs. The knobs were covered with velvet. And then you move on to the next section.
Well, let's cover Edgar Derby. He's there to watch him. And he is reading The Red Badge of Courage, which is a novel about a coward who fled from a battle in the Civil War. And I will remind you of the book that the author sat upon when he was visiting his mother in the old folks' home, the account of the deserter from World War II that was shot.
Mm-hmm.
What's his name? Yeah, do you guys remember what his name is?
I do not.
Let me look it up. It's Slavic, Private Slavic, or Slovak, I'm not sure. So I'm fairly confident that there's some significance there, but I mean, it's whatever. There's significance behind everything, and I think that's part of the problem, is that it's almost like a secret book that's written. We're getting tons and tons of stuff that I know that meant something to Vonnegut, and it doesn't necessarily mean anything to me because I'm not of the same time as Vonnegut, so I don't get all the references.
We don't, but I think it might be, you know, something important to say is that, you know, he wrote this book for him. He didn't write it for us. I think he wrote it for him, for his own psyche, for his own desire to just pour out his life and his experiences because he couldn't talk to anybody about this kind of stuff.
You're taking the word of the narrator.
I am.
This chapter has made me further believe that the narrator is completely unreliable.
I agree with that because we're skipping all over the place, but I'm just talking about Vonnegut.
Yeah, well, you don't know him.
It's true, I don't know him, but what I do know is that he had seriously PTSD big time.
You know that.
I know that for a fact, absolutely.
Yeah, you know that.
I was there.
He diagnosed him, I think, right?
Yeah, I think you were the doctor at the hospital.
Yeah.
All right, so funnily enough, that's where we go. We go from the dream about giraffes to 1948, just a few years after the war, and we're in a veterans hospital where Billy Pilgrim is going crazy, and the doctors agree.
Yeah, he was like, in his senior year of optometrist school,
mm-hmm.
ready to take on daddy's business with his fiance.
Mm-hmm.
But this is the time when he first went into the hospital.
Philip, let me ask you a question. Why do you think Billy's going crazy?
If you add up the sum of all of his experiences, a lot of people's psyches would crack. And it seems to me like his responses have been exaggerated. I mean, everybody there has to be afraid, has to be suffering.
Everybody where?
Everybody in the prisoner of war camp.
Okay, but we're not in the prisoner of war camp. We're at the VA hospital 3 years after the war.
Well, what I'm getting at is, but he's never left that place, and it's coming back to haunt him again and again and again and again because of all the things he's seen.
Okay, so what do you think it means that the doctors ascribe his insanity to his treatment as a child by his father, going to the Grand Canyon and being thrown in the pool? Because they don't think it had anything to do with the war.
I think that's very Freudian to put it.
Yeah, he's being psychoanalyzed.
I think that's too simple of a description. And that may be true, too. I mean, I think all of us carry a little emotional baggage from every single traumatic experience we've ever had. And that's normal. It goes back to my theory about the book is Vonnegut's opportunity to talk about the war. And I think he's pouring his soul into this. But it's hard to separate the narrator from Vonnegut.
But it's not hard to separate the narrator from Billy Pilgrim.
Oh, man. It's easy, in fact.
It is. Twice now, we're going to see.
Yeah, I'm a little confused on that. But I think that, he just has PTSD. Which, remember, people didn't comprehend what PTSD was.
Yeah, but the doctors don't.
You think the doctors do, but...
No, I think they don't. They think that he's going crazy because of the experiences he had in childhood. They think it was from the abuse that he suffered from his father.
I think that's ridiculous, but hey.
I agree, it's ridiculous. It's like Occam's razor, right? The simplest explanation is probably mm-hmm. true. He saw atrocious things in the war. It's had an effect on him. Why do they have to dig all the way back into his childhood looking for the problems when they're probably right on the surface? Fresh wounds, right?
Well, that's kind of where I was going with that thought, is...
Who's crazy?
Well, even the guy that he's sharing a room with, Rosewater...
Elliot
says that,
Rosewater?
Is that his name?
God bless you, Mr. Rosewater. Have you not read God Bless You, Mr. Rosewater?
No.
It's the book that Vonnegut published right before this one.
Oh, okay.
And he's the main character.
Oh, no kidding.
Does he like... Kilgore Trout.
Oh my goodness, does he ever.
Okay, all right, hold on a sec. So Rosewater, who's also in the hospital with Billy, basically the same thing. They both have found life meaningless, partly because of what they had seen in the war.
And what are they doing about it?
Oh, they were trying to reinvent themselves and their universe.
There you go. I think that's super important.
It is super important because as we find out more about Kilgore Trout's novels, it's sounding a lot like what Billy is experiencing with the Tralfamadorians.
Yes. Yes, that's true.
Almost like
he's making it up.
Right. And it's funny because I feel there have been moments in my life where I might have actually pilfered just a little bit from this book. And as I'm reading this chapter, I'm finding out a lot of it's coming from this chapter.
Right.
And maybe even some of my own beliefs and things, which is coming up when we see his mother.
Okay. Very good. Very good.
Yeah.
All right. So, yeah, Elliot Rosewater. God bless you, Mr. Rosewater, from 1965. Same year as Jacqueline Suzanne's book, by the way.
Interesting.
Oh, okay. Very good.
All right. So, Yule, thank you for bringing that up. That is the perfect... That is exactly, I think that's the crux of this entire novel, the sentence that you just quoted, essentially, about finding life meaningless, and then the way that they're dealing with it, the fact that they're reinventing themselves and the universe, and that they're doing it through science fiction.
The thing I liked right here is when Rosewater, Billy overheard him talking to a psychiatrist and said, "I think you guys are going to have to come up with a lot of wonderful new lies. or people just aren't going to want to go on living.
Call back to the suicides from the Grand Canyon?
Sure, why not?
Imagine something simple, like you were in a contest and you didn't win and you were really bummed about that and you thought you could have done better and somebody goes, it's okay, you tried your best. But you know you didn't try your best? I hate those little platitudes and lies, and I can imagine shrinks or psychiatrists doing the same things to try to boost your spirit, but nothing they say can do that. So I kind of feel that. They're going to have to invent new lies because the old ones aren't working. I get that. That connected to me.
I think they also have to justify their profession, which is why they're digging into Billy's childhood instead of talking to him about the war. But again, to your point, he may not be willing to talk about the war. So that may be the only thing that they're being given.
He can't even remember what he ate before the play, you know.
He doesn't remember eating.
Right.
It's not about what it was. He missed that entire section. He missed eating and he missed the beginning of the play entirely.
So also during the time that he's staying in the hospital, he's going to be visited by people, and right now he's being visited by his mother, who is like this chain smoking addict. And she's there and she's trying to, like, you know, console her son, and all he's doing is hiding under the covers of the bed he's in while she's talking mostly to Rosewater, I think, if I'm not mistaken.
They do have a conversation, but I mean, she's trying to talk to Billy, he's just not talking to her.
Right. He described his mother. It was a perfectly nice standard issue brown-haired white woman. Standard issue. I think that's pretty cool.
I like GI.
Yeah, exactly. And I like the reason why Billy was embarrassed or didn't want to be seen by her, and how she upset him. And it was because she put in such time and energy and effort to bring him into this world. He didn't really like life at all. And she brought, you know, she made him feel horrible and ungrateful towards her, and that's why he didn't want to, like, you know, communicate with her, I guess.
That's the sad part here, is that Billy is obviously suffering, and you have somebody who loves him, who wants to bring him out of his funk, as it were, and he doesn't want to bridge that gap, doesn't even want to give her an inch of...
Doesn't even say hello.
Nope, and he just covers his face with a blanket.
Do you remember the homeless person at his window? He didn't interact with that person. Like,
yeah.
he has a long history of not interacting. Mm. Like when Weary was beating him up, he just kind of giggled.
Now he is actively not communicating and acting. Like his effort
he's
to
avoiding.
Not act in front of his mother is an actual action.
Yeah, but he's just
which
avoiding.
Is almost more than all those other times, actually.
It's the bare minimum, dude. All he's got to do is pull his head under the blanket. That's it. Not a lot.
What about Rosewater with his overly enthusiastic manners and politeness?
Well, he's doing that so that he can pretend to get better. These are the things I'm supposed to do to get better, and I'm going to really give it a go, is what it sounded like. So he was being extra courteous and conversational with Billy's mother.
Mm-hmm. It was all very vanilla and very meaningless.
Right, but, you know, like, again, kind of like doing the bare minimum to get by, just a different version of it.
I mean, that might even be the opposite. You know, that conversation that he's having, like, that's the conversation that Billy's mom would like to have with Billy.
Uh-huh, and she even pretty much says that, too.
Rosewater's giving her what she wants, and Billy won't give her anything at all. And, like, it's absolutely meaningless. The stuff that comes out of Rosewater's mouth, the conversation that he has with Billy's mom is daft. Like, it's nothing. There's nothing there.
That section ends with...
A boy needs his father. No, wait.
Yeah, yeah. That brings it back to Billy Pilgrim's father died young, and Billy Pilgrim's father was kind of harsh on him. And the doctors think that his problem all goes back to his father, which may or may not be true.
Is she just aping what the physicians say about him then?
You know, I'm not sure. No, because this is what... Oh, sorry. This is what Rosewater says. He said a boy needs a father. Emphasis on needs.
Oh, I see. Well, is then he aping what a physician might have said?
He might have been.
He's just parroting what he thinks should be said or what's polite company, etc.
Sure, because later on, you know, she says, he's engaged to a very rich girl, and he's like, that's good. Money can be a great comfort sometimes.
It really can. Yeah, no,
it really can.
It's a very banal conversation. It's kind of it's kind of sickening to listen to.
It is, only because all of us have been in those conversations, unfortunately.
Oh, yeah, I still have them with family regularly.
I think you get it worse than me.
So this part of the chapter ends with Billy under his blanket falling asleep, thinking about the red badge of courage, which goes on to make him think about Edgar Derby. And then he thinks about a firing squad and, you know, the whole deal about the firing squads, whether or not somebody has blank bullets or not in there.
I don't think he was thinking about the red badge of courage. I think he woke up and Edgar's reading the red badge of courage.
He fell asleep. Oh, yeah, you're right. That's what it was.
But that's, you know, as it may be, it doesn't much matter. Did we, in this time, talk about the fourth dimension, maniacs from the fourth dimension? Because I think we just skipped right past that part.
No, we didn't.
We didn't talk. I'll tell you what. Let's talk about the maniacs from the fourth dimension when we talk about the other book.
Okay, cool.
All right, we'll just come back to this moment because it's not really important now. It's more important later on. Not only is Edgar Derby reading the Red Badge of Courage, he's reading the Red Badge of Courage by candlelight. And as we know from the narrator, a couple times now, those candles that were given, the bars of soap and the candles that were given to the Americans by the British, those were the only products that were made in Germany, and they came from the corpses of Jews, communists, fairies, and what was the other? Enemies of the state, I believe.
Who else were enemies of the state? Like other Germans or something like that?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, they rounded up their gypsies, they rounded up their Jews, they rounded up their homosexuals, and they rounded up anybody that was a dissenter. So a lot of intellectuals that didn't flee beforehand, etc. And I assume a lot of them ended up as bars of soap and candles.
So, you know, I gotta ask, I mean, I mean, I've heard it so many times throughout my life, but, like, how true is it that...
I don't know.
Is this
that they would go to the bother to make candles of them?
Yeah, exactly.
You mean like that? Like once you've done killing people, you kind of just like dump them or something like that?
Why don't you look it up? Why don't you look it up?
I'm going to Google that right now.
Yeah.
I'm going to Google it right now. Just do it from whoever doesn't say there was like 500,000 killed in Dresden.
Irving Frank.
So in my 10-second research, there was a news article, and somebody asked the question, did the Nazis really use bodies of murdered Jews to make soap? And the scholars say no, despite testimonies from Holocaust survivors. So
yeah,
there were stories that probably demonized them, but, you know, honestly, it's a lot easier to make soap other ways.
All right, so Edgar Derby's reading. And this is when we get the story of how Edgar Derby was captured and brought to the internment camp.
Yeah, they were worried about dying, and so they did what, you know, anybody that's worried about dying would do. They might give up.
Yeah, I don't want to die anymore. I take it all back. Well, it's an interesting story about Edgar Derby. It's not super brief, but that is, I mean, you can summarize this portion of the chapter really, really briefly.
It's this little brief moment where he's hiding underneath the cover from his mother, falling asleep, right? And he wakes up and he sees Edgar reading the book and he thinks of the firing squad and he thinks of how these guys got captured, and then he's right back in the Veterans Hospital.
Back in 1948, but this time he pulls his head out from under the covers and it's Valencia Merbel, his fiance.
He's like, is my mother gone? Like it was like, from one moment to the next,
yeah,
right?
Exactly. Well, it was for him.
It was for him.
So this is when we get a really great description of her as being as big as a house, I think. No, that's later on.
No, it's right here because she wouldn't stop eating. And in fact, she's eating a Three Musketeers as we speak.
Yeah.
She's eating candy bars while she waits for him to wake up.
And he says he doesn't want to marry her, that she is a symptom of his disease.
Oh, yeah. He knew he was going crazy when he heard himself proposing marriage to her.
I think he says she's ugly, even.
Yeah, he's not really enamored with her at all.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I don't know.
It's funny how we interpreted this completely differently. You said it was a symptom of his disease, and
the narrator said that.
You said it. The narrator said it. To me, this was just like tactical, self-arranged marriage for personal gain. That's all I got out of it.
Well, it does seem that way, except he's so blasé about everything. I could almost imagine like his mother or father knew somebody who knows somebody, and this is the reason why he's an optometrist now, and this is the reason why he's going to marry this girl now.
You guys do remember that he doesn't feel like he has any control over his life at all, right?
That's what I'm saying.
So how do you plot and plan for the future if you don't feel like you have any control? You can't. You don't. He's just along for the ride.
Like you said, he's going through the motions of life, one of which is find a mate and get married. But he's not, it doesn't seem at all, it's definitely does not seem at all like he's in love or enthralled with this woman. But it does give him advantage socially, professionally, and certainly financially to pursue this. So I think this entire marriage was completely tactical. I mean, there was no love there.
I mean, that's fine. I think that he's not doing it, though. Like, he said that he was startled or whatnot when he heard himself proposing to her. Like, he didn't want to, but he was doing it anyway.
He begged her, it says, to take the diamond ring and be his companion for life. He begged her, I guess. he's witnessing himself and saying he begged it. Like, from outside of his own head, he's witnessing this happen.
Beyond his control is how I took it.
No, I think there's a little more to that. He's striving for normalcy.
What's the symptom? What is his disease? Remember what his disease is. Is not wanting to live, right? Or not caring about life. So, kind of like how Rosewater was placating Billy's mom, Billy's placating Valencia, maybe? Going with the, you know, the motions.
He's definitely going with through it.
Yeah, this is what life is supposed to be. This is what I'm going to do to accomplish it. And, you know, it's very, very minimal, again.
That's true. You guys are actually changing my mind on this one. When I say it was tactical, there may have been something about that in his mind, but I think he was trying to find another human being to connect with where he could share his pain and suffering and try to find some semblance of normalcy in his life. You guys convinced me. It wasn't tactical.
I don't think he even wants to share anything with her. He doesn't tell her any of his stories. She describes him later on as being full of secrets.
Well, tactical is so...
That implies intent.
Well, yeah.
He's a passive observer of his own life. He does not seem like he's steering at all.
Yeah, I changed my mind. I don't think it was tactical at all.
No more Three Musketeers. She finished that. She's on to a Milky Way now.
Oh, she is.
Yep, she starts with the Milky Way.
She wants to, like, is there anything I can do for you? You know, can I get you a book? And he's like, why would I need a book? I got the best library in the world right here. And he's talking about Rosewater's, like, sci-fi
collection. Yeah, he has a trunk full of science fiction paperbacks under his bed.
Right, and he's reading one right now by Kilgore Trout.
The Gospel from Outer Space.
Right.
Which is described. It's given us a summary.
I think they describe it very well. It's like the visitor from outer space made a serious study of Christianity to learn, if he could, why Christians found it so easy to be cruel. I'm like, wow.
That is what it said. Do you see a purpose behind this description? Because he spent a little bit of time telling us the synopsis of this story, whereas the previous book that Rosewater had been reading, we didn't get much there other than the description of the Tralfamadorian seemed to be in that book.
Well, he does have a religious background.
Who?
Billy Pilgrim has a very religious background.
This is not Billy Pilgrim, and we've discussed this in the past recently, that it's not very. He has like a lukewarm religion.
My point here is that there is some skepticism about the Bible.
He said it was bad storytelling.
Yeah, bad storytelling. It's like he concluded that at least part of the trouble was slipshod storytelling in the New Testament.
Do you think there's any subtext?
Describe subtext. What do you mean?
What do you think he's really getting at?
I don't know. I try to figure that out because compared to the enormity and the magnitude of killing the Son of God. I don't know. Maybe there's something later in the book that I don't comprehend, but
I think that he's arguing that Christians have a tendency to be mean to people when they don't think they're going to get caught, or mean to people that they think that they can get away with it with.
And what you should do
is treat everybody as though they were Jesus, even though he's a bum, because that's what the whole religion is founded upon, is being kind and loving everybody.
On the next section, it did say, basically it summed it up, he's like, oh boy. He's talking about how the aliens interpret the crucifixion story. And the alien said, oh boy, they sure picked the wrong guy to lynch that time.
Yeah, they did.
And then the counterstatement was, there are right people to lynch.
If you're saying that, oh wow, they picked the wrong people to lynch in Jesus Christ because he was a poor slob that was heavily connected.
He was actually the Son of God, yeah.
Then the question you have to ask then is, who are the right people to lynch? There are people that are okay to lynch.
People who are completely aloof and unconnected, right.
Is Billy Pilgrim lynchable? That's what I want to know.
All right, so the silver pattern.
Yeah, the silver pattern. Again, it's another thing about Billy just not really caring. I don't think many men really care about that stuff.
That's not what I got from it. So she's asking him his thoughts on, like, which pattern would he like? And he immediately says, this particular pattern. And she's like, well, let's not rush into it. And so my interpretation of that is that she doesn't really want any input from him at all. She wants to make the decision. She's just pretending like he has a say.
Well, that's what I'm saying. It's always that way when it comes to this, right? Right.
I mean,
I don't know, Phil. How hands-on were you to the minute detail when it came to your wedding?
I had one task. I showed up. Anyway, where are we going?
And Billy traveled in time to the zoo on Tralfamador. We've made it essentially to the midway point in this chapter, roughly speaking.
Okay.
And we're going to break this chapter into two separate episodes because of time constraints. So do either of you have any thoughts about the beginning half of this chapter that you would like to further discuss before we close it down for the evening?
I'm not loving Billy Pilgrim quite so much right now.
Dude is daft.
Yeah, it's the not interacting and...
Yeah, he's passive. He's too passive.
I mean, I kind of felt like that he was always this way anyway. Like, we already saw it so many times, and it was obvious, but...
He doesn't seem that way in the beginning when the narrator was describing his life to us. It seemed like there might be some confusion about them being the same person, and the narrator seems kind of together and funny and entertaining, but Billy is kind of a dud.
Yeah.
And I just don't think they're the same person anymore. And, like, I'm starting to really have my doubts about Billy, and I'm also having real significant doubts about the narrator's reliability. Mm-hmm. And, like, I'm not convinced that this is a science fiction novel at this point. Look, I think Billy is a crazy person.
The only thing is that he gets kidnapped by the Tralfamadorians.
So he says...
I have to believe that part. That's the only thing I'm going to say I believe right now.
Okay.
He gets kidnapped after his daughter's wedding, correct?
Mm-hmm.
All right, so he is talking, or the narrator, when he's talking about Billy in the hospital with his fiance, they have not made a kid to get married yet, and he is thinking about Tralfamador. You know what I mean? It is in the head, or it is in the story. So that's the only thing that makes me think that he isn't just making up anything from his time in the hospital, because this is stuff that has happened. Like, he bounced, I don't know, it's interesting. Let's just say that.
So he picked up the description, to my thinking right now, he picked up the description of what the Tralfamadorians look like from that Kilgore Trout novel.
Yes.
And
oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah.
I mean, because they're described in there, basically. You know, the alien race, they weren't called Tralfamadorians, but they were described. And when they were described, they were essentially like the plumber's helper.
This guy's like the Dianetics guy.
L. Ron Hubbard? I don't know, maybe.
Billy Pilgrim's kind of like making his own little fanfic Hubbard verse or something like that.
Okay, so could I interject a little bit?
If it's good.
Billy Pilgrim got basically taken by the Tralfamadorians, but it all seems perfectly normal to him, right? He doesn't fret. He's not afraid. Right, he's not passing out or peeing his pants or all those things. In that reality, it all seems, I want to say normal, but there's zero indication that he's afraid that or concerned that he literally just got kidnapped by aliens.
Yeah, he handled it pretty well.
He handled it pretty well versus.
Well, we'll talk about that in the next segment.
Yeah, right? Well, no, versus when he got. You know, captured by the Germans. I mean, he's constantly he's an emotional mess.
Yeah, shell shock and all that. So, do you remember Yule? You said that Billy Pilgrim and Elliot Rosewater were both unhappy with life and reinventing themselves, and they were doing it through science fiction.
Yeah,
I mean, I think that explains. To me, at least, the inclusion of Tralfamadorians and etc. in Billy Pilgrim's life. Like, to me, he just seems like a crazy person that's making up stories to cope.
But why this alien nonsense then in the book? Well, they say famously, I guess, something like, it goes to the lines of this book, like, no matter how hard you want to try to not make this a science fiction novel, it's going to end up being a science fiction novel. Like, it's going to be perceived that way no matter what.
Well, it's got aliens in it.
It's got aliens in it. So then why did he put aliens in it if it wasn't meant to be a science fiction novel? You know what I mean?
Okay. What is...
I don't know. I'm just... Something I'm thinking about.
Okay. I think that he put aliens in it because he wanted to. Because he was a science fiction writer. That's what I think. I think that he's being a lot like Kilgore Trout right now is what I think. Did that sound like a science fiction novel to you? It sounded like a critique of Christianity.
Isn't a lot of science fiction a critique of...
I mean, are you married to Rhea Russell?
Christianity.
Or what? I don't know. None of the stuff that I've read has been, you know, a critique of Christianity.
Thing is like, this is the Children's Crusade. And when you look into what the Children's Crusades were, if you look into what the Crusades were, it was like, it was Vietnam all over again.
Right.
And on that note...
All right, so thank you for joining us. We are going to get on to reading the second half of the chapter, which we've actually already done. We'll see you in 9 days' time. Thank you for joining us. Keep reading, everyone.
Goodbye.
Goodbye. Not just goodbye, but goodbye. We love you, listeners, so thank you for listening.